It's already been a big weekend for a particular type of fiction. If you're the parent of a teenager or a soon-to-be teenager, you're likely well aware that The Hunger Games opened in movie theaters across the country this weekend.
And so it was decreed that each year the 12 districts of Pan Am shall offer up in tribute one young man and woman between the ages of 12 and 18 to be trained in the art of survival and to be prepared to fight to the death.
That's Donald Sutherland, the president of a post-apocalyptic country where teenagers are pitted against one another in mortal combat for the viewing pleasure of the populace. And if recent history is any guide, The Hunger Games will be the next huge film franchise to follow a successful series of books targeting a young adult audience. Bob Mondello reviews movies for All Things Considered, and he joins me in the studio. Hello, Bob.
It's good to be here.
First of all, for all of us over 30, give us a brief synopsis of The Hunger Games, and what did you think of it?
Well, I liked it quite a bit. It's basically reality TV on steroids. This is a dystopic North America after the fall of the United States to a terrible war. And the subservient districts of this place are kept subservient by this awful thing they do with the kids, which is to remind them every year of just how subservient they are. And if you're a kid and you're looking at this, it's sort of empowering because the kids are very strong and resist, and the adults don't. So, oh boy, this is the ideal teen picture, right?
Absolutely. Now, I mean, kids went nuts for these books. It's a hugely popular franchise. I was surprised to learn that this is a fairly recent trend, this young adult lit series just exploding at the box office.
That's fair to say. The big one is
Harry Potter. The boy who lived, come to die.
It made $7.6 billion with a 7-book, 8-movie franchise. Twilight is, I guess, the second biggest, which is about vampires and werewolves.
I, Edward Cullen.
And is a love triangle.
Take you, Bella Swan.
And that one has made over $2 billion. I mean, these are enormously popular.
As long as we both shall live.
And it's never happened in the past, really, largely because the box office mentality has changed. In the 1960s, people started thinking of young adults as somebody different from children. With the James Dean pictures, with The Outsiders, suddenly you aimed things at teenagers. And in 1970 or so, you started getting pictures like Jaws and Star Wars and things like that that were real blockbusters. Prior to that, you had hits, right?
Ah.
And you didn't get pictures that were aimed so definitely at family audiences in the summer, for instance, and they didn't click like this.
Would you count Lord of the Rings in that? Or what about Narnia?
Narnia was definitely aimed at kids. I would say that Lord of the Rings is aimed at a slightly older age group. It appeals more broadly. I mean, obviously, it appeals to teenagers, too, but it's not sort of aimed at them in the way that these other pictures are.
I mean, there were a lot of books that were also extremely popular and had large series. Nancy Drew. I grew up reading Nancy Drew.
True, and the Hardy Boys.
And the Hardy Boys.
Right.
Why did we not see huge Nancy Drew Hardy Boys movies?
Well, you didn't see movies, but you saw them on television. And what happened back then was, I mean, Disney, for instance, made a series of the Hardy Boys. My guess is that back in the days when there were only 3 networks, basically, that those series probably played to enormous audiences by comparison with the ones that are out there today. They might, if they had been in theaters, have made the kind of money that these pictures do now. Hollywood learned its lesson, let's say.
Bob Mondello reviews movies for this program. Bob, always great to see you.
It's always a pleasure.
In the Gilded Age was a city of epic contrasts, top-hatted swells and glossy carriages uptown, while just a few blocks south, poverty, crime, and overcrowding were the order of the day. And vice, let's not forget vice. New York was called a wide-open town, with gambling, prostitution, and liquor available on almost every corner. The cops and the Democratic machine politicians of Tammany Hall mostly looked the other way when they weren't actively involved. But in 1895, a new sheriff came to town, literally. Voters throughout the corrupt Democratic administration in favor of reform-minded Republicans, and Theodore Roosevelt was appointed police commissioner. Our book today is Island of Vice, Theodore Roosevelt's doomed quest to clean up sin-loving New York. And earlier this week, I met up with author Richard Zacks for a tour of Teddy Roosevelt's old stomping grounds.
All right, so where are we right now?
We're at 300 Mulberry Street.
300 Mulberry.
Which used to be police headquarters. And
this did? Right here?
This, yeah. I mean, this boring brick apartment building and this garage used to be police headquarters. And Teddy Roosevelt came in here like a hurricane to just clean up all the graft, all the corruption. It was mind-boggling. This was the dirtiest city policemen were taking bribes to do. It let you do almost anything. And Roosevelt, in hindsight, what he was trying to do, it's like somebody going into Vegas and just saying, there's going to be no more gambling.
Zacks leads me on a ramble around the Lower East Side, once one of the toughest neighborhoods in New York.
Delancey Street is, especially among Jewish people, is revered as, you know, Delancey Street, Lower East Side, push carts, all the rest of it. Well, 8, 10, 12, 14, and 16 Delancey Street were all brothels. So anyhow, I'm walking along here, and I'm just kind of looking for, because I know 6, 8, 10, and 12 are going to be former brothels. And what do I come on? The Bowery Ballroom, which is a club that has lots of performances. But at some point, this location was a brothel and the One Mile House next door as well.
And so it turns out it's still a bar
today.
It's
still in the entertainment business.
It's still in the entertainment
business.
And there were 150 more brothels within a mile of the street corner we're standing on. He leads me farther east on Delancey to the former site of a uniquely New York institution, a Raines Law Hotel. You see, liquor sales were illegal on Sundays, a fact that the cops ignored. Teddy Roosevelt decided he was going to change that. He was going to enforce all the laws, even if they were unpopular. His Dry Sunday campaign earned him the ire of almost everyone in the city. But it was reasonably successful at first, until the state legislature decided to get involved.
John Raines, state senator, comes forward and decides he's going to give Roosevelt even more ammunition to shut down the saloons on Sunday. He's going to pass a law that includes the fact that the saloons must be, their front doors must be locked, side doors locked as well, and their curtains open so the police could look in and see whether the bars were operating on Sundays. And it also had a clause that said hotels, if they had 10 bedrooms or more, could serve liquor 24/7 with a meal. And at first, when it went into effect April 1st, 1896, New York thought it was going to become just dead dry on Sundays. People were appalled. The headlines all said that. And then about a week later, more than 1,000 saloon keepers began converting their saloons to hotels, to Raines Law hotels. And no one knew if it would work. They just started converting. One guy converted an attic, and he said that only a midget could stand up in one of my 10 rooms. You know?
So they made 10 little closets upstairs.
Right. One guy used a coal bin. They made 10 little closets, but you know who the building inspectors were? They were Tammany Hall guys, and they wanted to let everybody drink and have a good time. So they okayed these 10 rooms, and not only could they serve on Sundays, they could serve all night long. New York really became the city that never sleeps because you had over 1,000 Raines Law hotels open all night long.
All night long.
Amazing.
Were they actually selling food?
Oh, that's the funny part. Eugene O'Neill wrote in one of his plays about seeing a mummified ham and cheese sandwich. Nobody wanted to eat the sandwiches. And there were like all these jokes about that sort of thing. One bartender yells to the owner, "We got to stop serving." Owner says, "Why? Do we run out of beer?" The bartender says, "No, some yokel ate the sandwich. There's not another one on the whole east side."
As nasty as that sandwich sounds, Raines Law hotels were almost respectable compared to other New York drinking establishments.
39 Mulberry was one of the stale beer dives, one of the really raunchiest, most derelict, bottom of the food chain joints to go have a drink.
They called them stale beer dives.
Yeah, the stuff was the leavings of the bars around the rest of the city. The guys would go and beg the leftover, buy the leftover stuff. Literally, they'd wipe the bar down and then have the rag, wring out the rag into a bucket, and that would be the kind of swill that they were selling for like a penny a can. And this was one of the most derelict parts of the city. And this was Fowl Valley's stale beer dive.
So what were the cops doing when all this was going on? Part of the answer lies here on Eldridge Street, one of the most notorious streets on the Lower East Side.
They had a police precinct house at 107 Eldridge, and that's where Captain Big Bill Devery, who was, notorious for see, hear, say nothing, eat, drink, pay nothing. He was the one of the most corrupt cops in New York City history. He winds up becoming chief of police.
And, he became the chief of police.
Yeah. He's indicted 4 times, beats the rap 4 times, becomes the chief of police.
Well, that worked out pretty well for him, then.
And it worked out even better. He co-founded the New York Yankees. True story.
When Teddy Roosevelt first went after corrupt cops like Big Bill Devery, Roosevelt was enormously popular. But back in the studio, Zax tells me that Roosevelt's inability to bend on enforcing even the most minor laws eventually did him in.
It played much better outside the city than inside the city. But he tried so hard. This city was so corrupt. And the idea of a man standing up and trying to enforce the law against drinking in saloons on Sundays, it's mind-boggling. Or the law against all the little petty briberies that went on, that the police shook down bootblacks and pushcart guys and all that. Roosevelt wanted an absolutely clean city, and this was Sodom. And Roosevelt didn't back down.
Why would he push so hard for something that was so unpopular? I mean, he was doing so well. And then he went for the one thing. It seems like, from your book, that most people wanted to get rid of some of the corruption. But he started targeting the thing that they enjoyed the most.
He did. I think Roosevelt didn't see any gray areas. He saw black and white. And this was illegal. It was conspicuous. Everyone knew about it. And he went after it. And there's another reason that could come into play, although Roosevelt didn't bring up this reason. But his brother had died of alcohol-related causes 8 or 9 months earlier. So it was fresh in his mind. When he went to his brother's house after his brother died, there were dozens of empty liquor bottles in the rooms. So Roosevelt had been personally hurt by this experience.
Was he always so inflexible?
I limited myself to 1895 to 1897. He was very rigid during that period. When he got an idea, he stuck with it. And he admitted a little regret to his sister in a private note. He said he hit an ugly snag, the Sunday saloon law, and he said that he had harmed the saloon owner. He didn't mind harming, but also some good people, for which I am sorry. But New Yorkers would never hear the word sorry from Roosevelt's mouth.
What was the impact of those 2 years of slogging it out day in and day out, fighting with everybody, pushing so hard? Did it have any sort of lasting impact?
I think the lasting impact was more for Roosevelt, frankly, than for the city. The lasting impact for Roosevelt was he learned to make speeches, more aggressive speeches. He learned to handle an audience. He learned to handle criticism. He found himself on the front page of newspapers, and he had to deal with it. He also achieved a national reputation as a law and order reform Republican, and it worked very well for him.
That's Richard Zax. He's the author of Island of Vice, Theodore Roosevelt's Doomed Quest to Clean Up Sin-Loving New York. Richard, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Kate Moore is bored.
She went grocery shopping and lugged bags. She prepared breakfast and packed lunches and cooked dinner and washed dishes. She sorted laundry, dried it, folded it, put it into drawers and on hangers and hooks. When she finished the chores, it was time to start each and every one of them again.
All-day domesticity is no life for a former CIA assassin. Luckily for Kate, though, her life is about to take a dangerous turn. Author Chris Pavone, that's his voice you just heard, set his new thriller, The Expats, in Luxembourg, where Kate has relocated with her banker husband. And when Kate meets another overly friendly American couple who keeps turning up in unexpected places, she begins to suspect that something's not quite right. Chris, I'm guessing that you were never a CIA agent, right?
I was not, no.
But you did live in Luxembourg.
I definitely did.
You have, in addition to living in Luxembourg, you have a lot in common with your main character, Kate.
I do. Both Kate and I left behind careers in the United States that we were no longer that enamored with. And we were ready to make a big change and ready to do something else and to be someone else. And we moved abroad for our spouses' opportunities to a place we'd never heard of or even remotely considered, a place like Luxembourg. And we discovered that being a stay-at-home parent to small children and setting up a whole new life in a whole new place where you don't speak the language, those things are partially exciting and mostly dreadfully boring. And when I started writing this book, I started writing a much more honest book about this life. And I'd written in excess of 100 pages. And then, sadly, that book began to bore me. And I was very disappointed to be writing a book that bored me. And so I cast around for other things to add to it. And one of the biggest themes in the book, and it's a real-life theme as well as the spy story theme, is the idea that there are certain times in your life when you want to or have to reinvent yourself. When I started trying to think about ways to amplify that universal experience, it struck me that if she had been doing something incredibly secret beforehand, that would really heighten the drama. Mm-hmm. And what is more secret than being a spy? And what is more secret than being a spy whose spouse does not know it?
Well, Luxembourg seems like a pretty good place then to reinvent yourself, to create yourself in a new place. And especially in your book, that plays a big role in the book. And everybody seems to be hiding something in this book.
Yes. I don't think that everybody in Luxembourg is hiding all that much, except their money.
Except for money.
Yeah, that's it. But it did strike me that it's a very, very strange place that's unconnected to a lot of people's other lives. And there's almost no way to stumble across somebody in Luxembourg who you knew somewhere else. And the things in your life that would get you caught if you were lying aren't there to get you caught.
There are so many layers to peel back from all of these characters, and they have such a difficult time being honest with each other and sort of having an open conversation about who they really are and what they really want. How important was that to the novel, to the storyline?
That's a basic premise of the novel, is that there is no character from the protagonists down to the bit players who will turn out to be the person you thought they were. They're all hiding something rather large. And even characters who appear in just one scene, I hope to make it clear that even that person at the beginning of the scene is not the same person at the end of the scene. And I think that's the way I feel about meeting a lot of people. The first reactions are so important and so hard to overcome, but so often not to be trusted.
They're not just hiding things from each other. They're also sort of hiding things from themselves.
Yeah, all a very exaggerated and heightened way of pointing out that we all have secrets of one level or another. And some of these are secrets we keep from our spouses, and some of them are simply secrets we keep from casual acquaintances, and some of them are secrets that we keep from ourselves. And in a way, Kate, the protagonist, is the one that has the most secrets. But there are four main characters in the book, and they're all keeping secrets, and they're all keeping those secrets from the most important people in their lives. And I think they lie rather well. Their lies are defensible, and there are even good ethical reasons to keep some of these lies, I hope. So they're not simple lies. They're not lies, I didn't do that. They're lies that have a reason to them.
You and your family are back in New York now.
We are.
And you're writing a new book now.
I am writing a new book.
Is Kate coming back, or is this the end of Kate?
Kate is coming back. I don't know if she's coming back in the new book. If she is coming back in the new book, it will not be as the protagonist. The new book will not be a sequel to this, but it might be related. Is that cagey enough for you?
That's good. That's good. Right. No, I like that. That's Chris Pavone. His new novel is The Expats. Chris, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
America is the land of the free and the home of the brave. And Amy Reading suggests in her new book, maybe the birthplace of the modern swindle. She tells the story of a Texas rancher named J. Frank Norfleet, who got taken in a con, then spent the next 4 years crossing the country, donning disguises and posing as a fool and a dupe, hoping to meet the men who'd conned him and return the favor. Amy Reading's new book is The Mark Inside, A Perfect Swindle, Cunning Revenge, and a Small History of the Big Con. Amy Reading joins us from the studios of Colorado Public Radio. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
And so how did this man, J. Frank Norfleet, who would grow to be admired for his intelligence and enterprise in seeking revenge, gets swindled out of his cowboy boots.
He got swindled partly because of his intelligence. He was a 54-year-old self-made man. He had gone from being an itinerant cowhand to owning his own cattle ranch. And the way that he grew successful was to do business with a handshake with other honest, straightforward men. And those were exactly the qualities that the swindlers who encountered him in Dallas when he went there on a land deal used to take him for everything that he was worth.
So when he met this guy named, and we'll hear this name a lot, Big Joe Fury, it was his, in a sense, his moral radar that was off?
Well, no. I think what happened was when he met Joe Fury, Fury represented himself as a broker on a stock exchange, someone with inside knowledge of this arcane financial world that was very different to Frank Norfleet than the world of cattle. So it's not so much that his moral radar was off as that he thought he was vaulting up into a new plateau of financial savvy. And they flattered his knowledge and his intelligence.
Well, I ask because, of course, there's a theory that a con like this works because the man being conned, if he's not exactly dishonest, he's at least maybe looking for a little edge.
Yes, and that is something that con men are always quick to point out, that you can't swindle an honest man, but a dishonest man has it coming. And there's certainly truth to that, but that's not the whole story. People are conned not only by greed and dishonesty, but also by qualities like friendship and altruism. And in Frank Norfleet's instance, he actually thought that he was helping his newfound friend. So it's not quite as a black and white situation as only bad people get conned.
When did he realize he was swindled?
Quite late. He realized he was swindled not after the first time they took a pile of money from him, but after the second time. He was absolutely devastated. He was worse than broke because he had borrowed some of the money he had just lost. And that's where his story gets unique. He could not bear to go back home and just swallow his losses.
He publicly vowed to avenge his swindle. And he set out on this quest to find the guys and bring them to justice. What were some of the poses that he wound up going through?
He posed as a cotton grower from Ferris, Texas. He posed as a celery farmer from Sanford, Florida. Very quickly on, he learned the con game as well as or better than the con men themselves.
And then in the story, what followed was a chase scene that Hollywood would find it hard to set up today, a high-speed train chase.
Yes, so when he finally catches up with Fury in Florida, he's got guns on his side and he's got Fury in handcuffs, but Fury is a man who does not like jail. So they're taking him across country by train, and at one moment when Fury has them all distracted, he simply puts his hands together and dives through the plate glass window of the train out onto the tracks. And then Norfleet does the same, because what else is he going to do? He's going to get his man. And so then there's this absolutely ridiculous chase back down through the train tracks on various cars that they've each hijacked until maybe I shouldn't spoil all of the story, but he does catch up with him at some point.
I got the impression in a couple of instances in the story that J. Frank Norfleet actually, in a way, grew to admire a successful con.
I think we all do, don't we? I think he's no different from many Americans. By the time J. Frank Norfleet was ensnared in the con in 1919, it had been evolving for several decades, so it was a very well-designed piece of stagecraft. And there is one moment, without spoiling too much of the book, where he's sitting down face-to-face with his nemesis, Big Joe Fury, and they absolutely hit it off. And they start to exchange the secrets of how they each tried to swindle each other. So there they are, two old hams sitting down as equals. And that tells you a lot about what you need to know about Norfleet.
You know, I'm very pleased to do this interview, although I must tell you I don't need to do this for a living, because just a few days ago I got an email telling me I'd won $200 million in the Luxembourg lottery. All I have to do is collect. which raises the question, is there anything new about these cons?
What I think is that the con never dies. It just changes costume. We all know how Ponzi schemes and Nigerian 419 schemes work, and yet they continue to make somebody an awful lot of money. And that gives the lie to something that certainly experts in the financial field would love to believe, which is that if you only know the structure of a con and how its mechanisms work, then you'll be inoculated. I think we can see that's not the case.
Can you be fooled?
Me personally?
Yeah.
Well, yes, I can. I think anyone can. But actually, personally, I operate my life, maybe this is dangerous to say on public radio, but in complete trust of people, because if you act as if everyone is potentially conning you, you'll be shut out from the business of life.
Did you think, by the way, this interview is going to be on the radio? It's a joke.
Did you think I had a PhD in American Studies?
Okay, you win. Amy Reading at the studios of Colorado Public Radio in Denver. Her new book, The Mark Inside, A Perfect Swindle, Cunning Revenge, and A Small History of the Big Con. Thanks so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
It's time now for this month's Backseat Book Club. Young listeners read a book and ask the author questions. Our March book is The Mysterious Benedict Society by Trenton Lee Stewart. Mr. Benedict is a benevolent father figure who assembles a team of four kids to carry out a secret mission. They wind up going on the adventure of a lifetime after answering a strange newspaper ad. Our colleague Michelle Norris has the story.
That ad appeared in a newspaper in a fictional place called Stonetown, and this is what it said. Are you a gifted child looking for special opportunities? Dozens of children answer the ad and try to conquer a series of mind-boggling tests, but only four are able to pass. All are orphans, and each is a genius in his or her own way. Author Trenton Lee Stewart explains how they come together and form a sort of pint-sized mod squad. Rennie
Muldoon is a remarkable problem solver. He's got a quick and facile intelligence, and he has a tendency to see things that other people miss.
Sticky
Washington, so-called sticky because everything he reads or observes sticks to his brain. He has a photographic memory.
Kate.
Athletic and acrobatic. She's handy with all sorts of tools. She's sort of a genius at solving physical problems.
And Constance.
She just appears to be a very small, slightly pudgy, angry poet who's always making rude poems about the people around her.
Mr. Benedict uses all those tests to find kids who have the right stuff. They need to go undercover and save the world. Assuming different identities, they attend a school that's run by the evil Mr. Curtin. He's up to no good. The kids must use their skills to stop his plan for worldwide mind control. The Mysterious Benedict Society is filled with twists and turns and constant conundrums. It's not just mysterious, it's also fantastic and heart-thumping and just plain fun. I asked Trenton Lee Stewart which came first, the curious characters or this world that they occupy.
The ideas really started with images that occurred to me in a fairly short stretch of time when I was between other writing projects of puzzles or riddles. The first one was an image of a child. I didn't know yet if it was a boy or a girl. Taking an incredibly difficult test that was more than it appeared to be. I knew there was a secret to the test. So once I started asking who these kids are, why they're taking these difficult tests, it sort of led to the notion that they were being recruited for a difficult mission that only children could accomplish.
Now, there are tests of some kind or another throughout this book. Not all of them are pen and paper tests, but these children are tested constantly. Their mettle is tested, their smarts, their physical strength, their ability to find their way out of sort of a bad situation. For people who haven't had a chance to dive into this book yet, give us a great example.
So there's a place in the book where early on where the children are led into a room one at a time. And in this empty room, on the opposite wall above another door, there's a large sign that says, "Cross the room without setting foot on a blue or black square." And when they look down on the floor, they see that they are standing in a red circle, and Otherwise, the floor resembles a giant checkerboard with alternating rectangles of blue, black, and yellow. And there's far more blue and black than there is yellow, so that it appears that it would be impossible to cross the room without stepping on blue or black, since the yellow parts are so widely scattered that it would be difficult to jump from one to the other. That's a riddle that the kids all solve in a different way.
Sticky crawls across, never putting his foot down. Kate jerry-rigs her way in an acrobatic feat. Constance, well, she just plops down and refuses to participate. And Rennie?
What he notices that no one else notices is that although the sign says cross the room without setting foot on a blue or black square, the pattern on the floor is actually composed of rectangles, not squares per se. And so he realizes that the sign is meant to mislead you into thinking that the rectangles are squares. So it's an example of misdirection, which happens all the time in riddles, where something is stated to you, which leads you to suppose something, which is not necessarily true.
We count on NPR's Backseat Book Club readers to lead the conversation. And first up, a query from Trenton Lee Stewart's hometown, Little Rock, Arkansas.
My name is Mary Policino. I'm in seventh grade, and my question is, did you come up with all the riddles and puzzles yourself?
Yes. Part of the inspiration for writing this kind of book was a chapter in The Hobbit called Riddles in the Dark, in which Bilbo Baggins, the Hobbit, is in this life or death riddle puzzle contest with Gollum. And I wanted the whole book to be just like that chapter. And I think when I started to write The Mysterious Benedict Society that I had that chapter in mind, that kind of thing in mind, the notion of having to be able to solve puzzles and riddles because enormous stakes rode upon your ability to do that. Mm. So I did actually write all the puzzles, created all the puzzles and riddles in the book. A lot of them were already in my brain before I started out to write the book, but then more were called for. And so I really had to sit down and think about what makes a riddle a successful riddle, so that I could create new ones as the narrative demanded.
Were you yourself a gifted child looking for special opportunities?
I guess I was. I was a smart kid, and I loved books, and I wanted to be involved in these big adventures that the kids go on in the Narnia Chronicles, for instance, or that The Hobbit goes on, or that the rabbits go on in Watership Down. I was always interested in the possibility maybe of finding my way into a big adventure. I wanted to go to Sesame Street. I mean, I remember distinctly running through my neighborhood thinking I knew how to get to Sesame Street, you know, and then finally finding myself amongst some scrub trees and realizing I don't know where to go from here. I had to just, you know, mope back home.
Elijah Rasul lives in Ann Arbor. He's 8 years old, and he has a simple question. Do you know Morse code?
I am much better at it now than I used to be. You might not be surprised to learn that I receive a number of letters from young readers in Morse code. So I know a little, but I didn't know it when I started out to write the book. I just thought that it seemed a good fit for the character's mission. I do feel compelled to solve them, though, because if a 13-year-old decided to write me a letter in Morse code saying, you know, help, I'm being held hostage by aliens, I would feel like I don't want to leave this young reader abandoned.
Well, Elijah Rasul says you're an awesome writer.
Oh, thank you.
That's Trenton Lee Stewart. His book is The Mysterious Benedict Society, the first in a 3-part series. You can be the first to read the fourth book, a prequel to the series called The Extraordinary Education of Nicholas Benedict. You'll find it at our website. I'm Michelle. NPR News. And in case your Morse code is a bit rusty, that was Michelle Norris. And here's what's coming up in the next few months. Our April book is Paul Fleischman's Seed Folks, about the birth of an inner city garden.
And in June, we'll have a reader's choice. So we want you to cast your vote. You can do that and find out more about NPR's Backseat Book Club at npr.org/backseat.